The top stories. Iran fires ballistic missiles on the final day of its military drills in the Persian Gulf, a day after testing a precision strike cruise missile. Saudi Arabia intensifies its airstrikes on the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, hitting a stadium and an area near a hospital in its latest attacks. Also ahead, two major American airlines are forced to cancel dozens of their flights amid a surge in COVID cases across the U.S. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Our top story, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says its large-scale drills in the Persian Gulf area serve as a real warning to Israel. IRGC Chief Major General Hossein Salami says the regime's hands will be cut off if it carries out its recent threats against Iran. Salami says the Israeli officials should watch their words about Iran. The IRGC was holding the fifth and final day of its maneuvers in southern Iran Friday. The last day of the drill saw the force carry out simultaneous attack on a mock target by over a dozen ballistic missiles and drones. The force said the attack was 100% successful. A day earlier, the IRGC also test-fired a naval cruise missile with pinpoint accuracy. The exercises are part of regular Iranian military drills. On that story, let's bring in Mr. John Bosnich. He's a journalist and activist, as well as a political analyst who comes to you via Skype out of Belgrade. Sir, it's good to have you with us. Your reaction to what I just read, you know, the head of Iran's IRGC actually saying a few words regarding how these maneuvers will have to be interpreted by the Israeli officials.
Well, when you've got a country like Israel threatening military action against you regularly, the only possible response is to prepare one's own defenses. And Iran has made it clear that Iran is prepared to defend itself and also make counterstrikes against any aggressor. This is the proper position for any country. And in fact, the United Nations should have already intervened to warn Israel against its threats of aggressive warfare.
And, well, you know, in cases that it obviously does not intervene, the best course of action seems to be... I want to get your assessment on the course that Iran has taken in order to defend itself and its interests, and basically to talk with the language of military with those who are actually attacking, not attacking, but threatening it with military force, including, of course, more importantly, Israeli, some Israeli officials, as well as, well, you know... Sometimes also the U.S. talks about, and I'm putting it in quotes, other options on the table regarding Iran.
Unfortunately, we can't really separate the USA and Israel, because Israel has such an incredibly high degree of influence in U.S. government policy, both in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party, that Israel and the United States can be seen almost as one aggressor when it comes to Iran. The United States is also exercising influence on its European military colonies, which is what they are, through NATO. So not only is Iran surrounded and outnumbered by these foreign powers, but Iran has the best option of turning to its own supporters in Russia and China, because the world is tired of war after war after war run primarily by the military-industrial complex of the United States, but largely on the orders of Israel. This has got to stop, and Iran has made both the proper domestic defense moves and the international tie-ups with other countries which have faced U.S. and even Israeli aggression.
Let's imagine for a moment what kind of an impact do you think these words by the IRGC had? And of course, you know, just recent developments in Iran's military power, including the ones that were showcased in this recent maneuver, will have on the minds of the Israeli and on the words of the Israeli officials from this point forward.
Well, you know, in this situation, we're likely to see a reversal of the old David and Goliath story. In this case, it looks like Iran would be the David, and Goliath would be Israel and the United States. And I'm quite confident that one properly placed military strike from the defense forces of Iran could bring down the entire military-industrial complex of Israel and the United States. And this is what the advantage is in having the most advanced, most highly developed missile defenses in particular. Mm-hmm. The United States is producing airplanes that cost hundreds of millions of dollars per unit. And one well-placed, properly controlled missile can bring one of those down. Once those airplanes start falling from the sky, the entire aggressive tone of Israel and the United States will have to change.
Okay. And, you know, one thing that is really interesting to discuss, I believe, Mr. Bosnich, is that sometimes as officials of certain states and countries, you may show reactions that basically will have use for your own propaganda, for your own media, and for your own people. But deep inside in your inner circle, you know the answer. These maneuvers, and of course, you know, the idea of attacking Iran, how much do you see this to be the case that I just mentioned, you know, on the minds of the Israeli officials, the ones who actually know the truth?
Well, I would say that we're now getting to the point where defensive technology, especially interceptor missiles, is so well developed, and Iran is among the countries that have these defenses now, that the entire brute force global bully attitude of the United States military complex and its partner Israel is facing a potential complete defeat. If that happens, the entire world would change. And I understand very well that the eastward drive of NATO and the United States and Israel could be and should be stopped by the combined efforts of not just Iran, but Iran's technical and economic partners in Russia and China. But I must say that there is nothing wrong and nothing that could be condemned about Iran conducting full-scale military preparations to defend itself in the face of open, public, and repeated threats of war.
Understandably, sir. Many, many thanks. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade. You have a good day. Saudi Arabia has conducted deadly artillery attacks on Yemen's northwestern province of Sa'ada. Local media say the shelling left one person dead and 11 others injured. It came a day after Saudi aircraft hit a number of residential areas in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. One of the strikes hit a site near a hospital. The details on the casualties of that attack are yet to come in, though at least one civilian injury is confirmed. The damage caused to the neighborhood paralyzed the hospital. Locals were shaken by the strike.
The violent attacks hit the residential area in this street, causing damage to Olya Hospital and residential houses.
The Saudi Arabian strikes targeted my bus. Shattered windows are everywhere. They attacked when everyone was resting at their homes.
This is a residential area and there is no military base or camp around here. May God damn the US, Israel and their allies, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and anyone who targets innocent people late at night.
Saudi fighter jets also bombed a sports complex in northern Sana'a. Riyadh claims the target was a weapons depot. Yemen's Ansarullah movement, however, denies this. Following the attack, Yemen's Olympic Committee called on international bodies to put an end to Saudi attacks against sports facilities. Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen in 2015. It has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead. Abdul Latif al-Washali has given us the latest details on Saudi Arabia's airstrikes on the Yemeni capital.
It's the place where I live. They were a few meters away from my house. We've heard them actually at the night at 10 and or 2 and 10 minutes p.m. or a.m. I'm sorry. We heard the bombardment. The windows broke. The tank of water broke. They targeted only a residential area, and it is very populated. There are a lot of people. I walked down to the street last night and saw the aftermath of the bombardments. The people there were very angry, as it is a very crowded area. There are thousands of people in that street. It's in the heart of the city of Sana'a. It's called Zubairi Street. And all the world, all the Yemenis, I mean, know that this place or this area is a very populated area. So it was against the international law that protects civilian areas and civilian facilities. There were a civilian injured in that attack, and I believe that he is in the hospital now. Maybe he will live, maybe he will die. Most of the injuries, they die after a day or two when they go to the hospital.
Welcome to News Review. A Palestinian woman is dead after an Israeli settler runs over her in a northern occupied West Bank. The 60-year-old succumbed to her injuries before medical help arrived. The incident took place in a Palestinian residential area near Ramallah. It came hours after Israeli settlers, backed by regime forces, attacked a Palestinian village in a nearby area. The troops fired rubber bullets and tear gas, injuring at least 125 Palestinians. Israeli rights group Beit Salem says it has documented over 450 settler attacks on Palestinian villagers, or villages, that is, since early 2020. The group says Israeli forces did not intervene to stop the attacks in the majority of cases and often actively joined in. To discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in Mr. Barry Grossman. He's an international lawyer and political analyst joining us out of Bali, as well as our own correspondent, Mona Kandil, who also comes to you live via Skype out of Ramallah. It's good to have you both on the show with me. I guess I'm going to begin with an update from Ramallah and ask Mona to fill us in regarding the latest information. Mona?
Well, yes, as you have said, 60-year-old Palestinian woman Ghadir Masalmeh Fuqaha from the Palestinian town of Sinjar, northeast Ramallah. She was standing with her husband near the road in order, waiting for a taxi to pick them up. However, that road is also used by Israeli settlers. One of the Israeli settlers was driving his vehicle. He ran over the Palestinian woman and fled the scene. Immediately, the Palestinians gathered around the old woman. Then she was transferred to hospital and she succumbed to her injuries. The Israeli military issued a statement saying that they are investigating the incident and that they don't think the settler ran over his vehicle on purpose, killing the woman. But all the eyewitnesses there can say that she was not standing in the middle of the street or even crossing the street. So it's hitting her on purpose. In the same place in 2014, a similar incident had taken place when an Israeli settler ran his vehicle over two Palestinian school children. They were returning back from school to their village, Sinjar. One of those children, female children, was killed and the other was seriously wounded, and this has caused her disability. Following the recent incidents that what happened yesterday in the village of Burqa, when thousands of Israeli settlers went to the evacuated settlement of Homish in order to prevent the Israeli military to destroy some buildings there. There were clashes between the Palestinian residents of Burqa and the settlers. We are speaking about some 125 Palestinians were wounded, and not only from attacks by the settlers, but also from a fire by the Israeli soldiers there.
Okay, let's turn to our esteemed guests from Bali, Barry Grossman, now to come in and please share with us, sir, your idea. How do you react to this latest straight up violence that has led to the death of this Palestinian woman, unfortunately?
I find it very difficult not to get angry on a daily basis. This tsunami of war crimes, insofar as the so-called state of Israel is concerned, and murders, insofar as the actions of individual settlers, is unnerving and beyond outrageous. It's always important to remember that this is the West Bank we're talking about. This is not that part of occupied Palestine where it won't be open up, following the aborted partition in 1948. One could argue, unsuccessfully, I might add, that the Israelis have some claim to a modicum of legitimacy. This is the West Bank, and but for the Oslo Accords, the occupying forces would have no business there. And I guess what troubles me about this is we're seeing this happen over and over and over again without any concern whatsoever being shown by those involved that they might be subjected to a proper criminal investigation. Insofar as there are investigations, they're quite clearly done to create the appearance that the occupation is policing itself in order to avoid any kind of international action in the appropriate international court for criminal actions and war crimes.
And thank you for being with us for this edition of News Review. United and Delta Airlines say the surge in coronavirus cases nationwide directly affected their flight and other staff. The U.S. is facing a new surge in COVID cases as the Omicron variant takes hold. The government, however, has failed to impose vaccination requirements for travelers. Well, many, many thanks for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said.
Contrary to Washington's claims, America's.
President Raisi has emphasized that.
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran is host to over 3.5 million refugees, under a million of which are documented Afghans and Iraqis. It is one of the longest, largest, and most protracted urban refugee situations the world has seen, given it started in 1979 with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Iraq's problem followed, but theirs majorly began with the American occupation of 2003. Although, since the 1990s, the common Iraqi man has been devastated by U.S.-imposed economic sanctions. The infant mortality rate in Iraq increased 150% from 1990 to 2005. For many an Afghan, a return home is a dream long lost. They see no choice but to risk their lives in crossing the border to get into Iran, braving treacherous borderland and tough mountain passes. The situation in Iraq isn't peachy either, but Iraqi numbers in Iran are negligible. Why are Iran's neighbors set in this direction, and what keeps them here? To see how some of their lives went this side of the border, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. For over 40 years, whatever peace of mind the Afghans may have found sporadically never lasted. They were attacked by America in 2001, and with the U.S. staying gone, the dust never settled. Finally, with the U.S. pullout this year, a Taliban takeover became complete in August, and 400,000 more Afghans have poured into Iran since. They tend to settle for unskilled, low-paid labor. But that's not every refugee or immigrant's life story. A one-hour drive led me to what turned out to be an inspiring case. Our trip en route to slushy suburbs south of Tehran didn't seem inspiring, so it came as a pleasant surprise when we found a wooden furniture factory bazaar on a slushy, wide dead end. With several, mostly Afghan lads, putting his furniture together, the bulk of goods does tell of a success story of one Mr. Yousefi.
I came to this country in 1994. I was in the construction business until around 2003, when I started working for a company that specialized in this. That's how I got familiar with this job. It was around 2007 that we got a small workshop that was around 80 square meters where we provided various services. For example, we'd paint chairs for a fee. We continued the job and expanded the business to its current size.
I asked whether Iran had done him a greater service or whether he was contributing more to Iranian society.
I used to work in the construction business. We used to build street curbs and other physically demanding jobs at very low costs. This is a service in itself. As a foreign national, I may be forced to accept 800,000 tomans for a chair, but an Iranian colleague and neighbor of mine wouldn't accept a job at that amount. I'll take very slim profit margins to let the wheels spin. Our growth has been weaker compared to our Iranian counterparts, but we've worked hard for it. I started work at 8 a.m. and finish at 10 p.m. With such dedication, you'll eventually grow.
The self-fashioned entrepreneur showed me around his two workshops, one for carpentry and the other for finishing, as well as his exhibition warehouse. He uses all grades of wood but focuses on affordable raw material with a better finish. It's a modest income, he explains, in spite of the bulk of work and production, but he employs about 12 people at a time for what he called regular wages. I got to talk to one of the lads in his employ, his own nephew, Mohammad, born in Iran.
I studied the first 4 years of the elementary school in Iran. After that, I studied at a charity school in Shahrare for 3 more years. But then, because we weren't in a good financial situation, I had to drop school and started tailoring. We used to live in Varamin, but then my uncle offered me a job asking me to drop tailoring and go work for him and learned new skills in furniture making. I already know tailoring, so I grew very fast and became successful.
What brought his elders to Iran in the first place is an experience probably alien to Mohammed's generation. Although, given Iran's economic difficulties, the high rate of inflation and weakened rial and U.S. sanctions still ongoing, they do envisage an end to what comforts they may have acquired. Although Iran has been accommodating to those who managed to get in, even now that it's having to reverse its policy of looking the other way as people cross over into Iran.
When we came here, we knew that we'd had to work hard because we're in a foreign country and the Islamic Republic of Iran might at any moment decide to deport non-Afghan nationals, including Pakistanis, Indians, Arabs and Syrians. We knew we had to work hard so that if push came to shove, we'd have enough to live by for a while when we go back home.
Till today, since midsummer, every day 4,000 to 5,000 are making their way in from Afghanistan, negotiating dangerous routes for $500 to $600 per head with smugglers. That's a fee quadrupled since the situation back home has become scarier looking, and an economically suffering Iran is negotiating tighter border controls with the Taliban. Not everyone pays that much, but it's never a comfortable trip at times in car trunks into any city they can get to. Mr. Abedi is an expert on the matter. He joined us on Skype. Do listen in.
The most important opportunity Iran has provided for immigrants is their security. Unfortunately, security is a big regional issue, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. Three countries with the most immigrants to Iran, which have imposed a heavy economic burden on the country. They enjoy such security that they engage in economic activities. Afghans especially have a remarkable presence in Iran's economic activities. So do Iraqis.
Globally, nearly 5 million Afghans are displaced outside, 90% of whom are hosted by Iran and Pakistan. What's noticeable about Iran is that while 4% of refugees live in 20 settlements managed by the Interior Ministry's Bureau for Aliens and Foreign Immigrants Affairs, that's Bafia, refugee populations are generally protracted here. That's to say, 96% of refugees live scattered among Iranians in cities, towns, and villages. What's also noteworthy is that children can now receive nationality even from an Iranian mother.
I love Afghanistan and I'd love to go see my country, but I have the same feeling for Iran because I was raised here and most of my friends are Iranians. I've grown to be like them, and when I'm around them, I feel like I belong here.
Going by government figures, in October 2020, there were 800,000 registered refugees living in Iran. 780,000 of them Afghan and 20,000 Iraqi. Additionally, nearly 600,000 Afghan passport holders live in this country. Refugees are given access to education, health, and livelihood opportunities. The idea is to help them thrive, not just survive.
The point is that granting citizenship can impose various costs on a country, as a large number of people would be added to the population, which needs facilities, services, and budget, and might even create security concerns for the country. But all in all, the Iranian society has been accepting the migrants because we see most of the migrants as our brothers and sisters, including the Afghans and Iraqis.
Time for a success story of a different kind. That would be of a man who spent his early years in Iraq but came to Iran around 25 years ago to set up shop. You don't hear many frightful escape from home stories with the Iraqis, but if there are 5 million Afghan refugees outbound, there are over 9 million Iraqis displaced, if not abroad, at home. How things work out for them once they're across the border, Mr. Hariri will tell. We traveled a pretty distance on a foggy day to meet him at a successful big cosmetics factory.
As a national from neighboring Iraq and a Shia, I feel safe here and hope the ties between the two countries will strengthen every day. That's why I chose Iran for investment and expansion of my business. Thank God, I'm successful and have 120 Iranian workers covered by social security insurance.
The 2003 US invasion displaced approximately 1 in 25 Iraqis from their homes. And fighting connected with Daesh or ISIS contributed to additional displacement. Yet Iraqis don't file into Iran as Afghans do. Mr. Hariri, Maher Hariri of Maher Arasam Makeup, says,
I'm extending my residency every year despite a lot of problems that I'm facing. As an Iraqi national, I can't have a property in my name. My car isn't in my name because I don't have a bank account. My factory isn't in my name. The only thing I have going for me is that my wife is an Iranian. So everything has gone in her name. But most other immigrants aren't this lucky.
Quite a business. It's not always you get to see the process of production and enjoy seeing the finished product. I don't know about the cameraman, but I thoroughly enjoyed seeing my favorite products being made and finding them on display afterwards. Mr. Hariri seemed equally willing to help me choose hair dye colors or to show the team around his company from lab to warehouse. The company, factory rather, which has built over 5,500 square meters in two stories, has been passing with flying colors over past years, which means they can also export their wares. Our visit this year happened to coincide with a same-day visit by inspectors. time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
For the past 20 years, displacement has followed US and NATO wars in West Asia. But the West doesn't appear inclined to take responsibility. Western humanitarian bodies have called on their governments to step up, though. More on Western attitude toward the refugee situation in this region coming up. But that'll be after a quick media review to see what other news outlets have to say. For that, I give you Al Mohammed.
Welcome to another news section. I'm Mohammed Gord, and in this episode, we will be taking a look at foreign nationals in Iran and the country's decades of aiding immigrants and refugees. In Iran, thanks to the government's progressive and inclusive policies, refugees have been given access to educational, medical, and livelihoods opportunities, allowing them to thrive and not just survive. Now, Iran says it expects Europe to take responsibility towards refugees. According to Tehran Times, the Director General of Foreign Affairs and Immigrants of the Iranian Interior Ministry has said Tehran expects European countries and the international community at large, including the United Nations, to act responsibly in allocating the necessary fund and provide comprehensive support for Afghan refugees flooding into Iran. Mahmoudi said that Iran has been hosting and providing services to Afghan refugees for more than four decades. In a statement, the Interior Ministry official has said, Iran has been a major supporter of refugees and displaced persons, and despite economic difficulties and unfair sanctions, has provided valuable service to a large number of Afghan refugees and foreign immigrants without any discriminations in the areas of health, education, livelihood, vocational training, and employment. Stating that the government of Iran, unlike some countries, has not housed refugees in camps, Mahmoudi added, despite the little aid from international organizations, Iran has provided comfortable living conditions for the refugees nationwide. The Middle East and North Africa Financial Network has released a report titled South Korea Donates $2.5 million to Help Afghan Immigrants in Iran. According to the report, the Republic of Korea has donated $2.5 million to UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, UNICEF, and the UN Children's Agency to offer help and plans to aid Afghan immigrants in the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Wednesday, the ambassador of the Republic of Korea in Iran inked a deal of partnership regarding this matter with agents of both UN agencies, in attendance of the UN resident coordinator in Iran, Mr. Stefan Priestner. According to the report, the Korean ambassador has said that the Republic of Korea will remain as a staunch supporter of the UN and the host country of Iran in the spirit of burden sharing. With today's donation of $2.5 million, the Korean government's contribution for the last 7 years to address the Afghan refugee issue in Iran marks about $30 million. I sincerely hope that today's donation contributes to coping with the crisis and ameliorates the living standards of the newly arriving Afghans and the local people. Meanwhile, Priestner says UN agencies cooperate to support the Islamic Republic of Iran in the best way possible. We are grateful that the Republic of Korea is increasing the partnership with us by contributing generously to finding joint solutions to the crisis not only in Iran, but the entire region. Thanks for joining me in another news section. Now back to Leila.
The UN's refugee agency, UNHCR, continues to advocate for more third country solutions for Afghan refugees. That's to resettle them, seeing the pressure host countries are under. Also, in Iran's case, its economic problems are no help to the refugee population it hosts either. Not if the current state of the economy persists, not in the long term. But for all its efforts, in 2020, UNHCR only received a resettlement quota for 120 refugees in Iran. That's been the lowest since the refugee agency started resettlement activities in this country in 1999.
Unfortunately, the Western European countries don't provide much assistance to Iran in its fight against drug trafficking. If anything, they take measures against Iran. We see the same attitude from the international community and bodies like the United Nations and the European Union with regard to immigrants in Iran. Their financial assistance might cover only 2-3% of all the funds Iran is spending. Iran has vaccinated many Afghan and Iraqi asylum seekers against COVID-19. Iran is providing them with facilities, including educational ones. But unfortunately, the aid Western and international organizations are paying Iran is a paltry sum.
Iraq's refugee crisis has impacted both Iraqis who fled and those left behind. Professionals such as engineers, artists, academics, and doctors were among the first to escape the war. And this stripped Iraq of many cultural institutions and frontline services when it needs them most. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimated that 70% of Iraqis lack access to clean water and 80% lack sanitation. That's conditions leading to cholera epidemics.
I believe most Iraqis have a sense of business, and wherever they go, they help build the place and do considerable work. That's why many Iraqis who've emigrated to other countries are successful. I know many who invested in Canada, Germany, and Dubai. Many also stayed in Iraq. As I mentioned earlier, I have strong feelings for Iran.
To put in more on how much Iran is doing for refugees, who prefer the term immigrants, by the way, given they have also contributed to Iran with the work they've put into building apartment blocks in Tehran, etc., free primary health care, including vaccinations, essential medicines, and maternal and child health services, are available to all refugees, regardless of their documentation status. Refugees also have access to universal public health insurance to cover secondary and tertiary health care, on par with nationals. UNHCR reports that in 2021 it has been covering the insurance premium for up to 120,000 of the most vulnerable refugees. In Iran, refugee, undocumented, and foreign children study beside Iranian children, as primary schooling is allowed and free for all, even secondary education. Higher education is also accessible to Afghans and Iraqis, as in 2016, Iran's government scrapped refugee-specific fees. Iran may be calling on the international community for burden sharing, but actually it has taken refugee hosting in its stride. West Asia has an ancient history of war and peace, interaction and intermarriage between its lands, which now have modern borders drawn between them. Today, Iran and Afghanistan share, yes, a border of over 900 kilometers, and Iran and Iraq share a border of over 1,500 kilometers. That's a lot border-wise and means a greater inflow of asylum seekers.
Iran can create many problems for Europe and Western countries by opening up routes to the continent and using them as leverage to apply pressure on the West, just like what Turkey and some countries in Eastern Europe are doing. Iran can do the same, but the Islamic Republic isn't after taking advantage of migrants and refugees to put pressure on the West. I think Western countries should appreciate that.
In a meeting mid-December with the Hungarian foreign minister, Iran's president Raisi described Iran's assistance to Afghan refugees as a humanitarian and Islamic duty. He said, "We support Afghan refugees whether they want to stay in Iran or pass through Iran." But at the same time, he reminded Western countries of the many promises they made to help Afghan refugees but never fulfilled. He deplored, "The fruit of 2 decades of NATO and US presence in Afghanistan is murder, crime, bloodshed, and helplessness of the Afghan people. More than 30,000 Afghan children have been disabled as a result of the American presence in Afghanistan." Thing is, unlike Iran, Western states overall don't exactly respect refugees. Refugees may become residents in powerful Western countries and make it big, but they face a very different sort of attitude, one that can border on life-threatening situations.
Our country has provided refuge to at least 3.5 to 4 million refugees. That figure doesn't bear comparison with the number of refugees Western European nations have admitted from Afghanistan. A country like Australia is accepting 50,000 refugees. Sweden and Norway are letting in way fewer than that. The number of Afghan refugees living in Iran is perhaps larger than all Afghans living in Europe. The burden to house the refugees has fallen on Iran and Pakistan.
According to a 2017 report, which still holds today, a report by the European Network Against Racism, that is, in the European Union, EU, migrants are increasingly facing racist violence and hate speech, as well as discriminatory policies and attitudes. Discriminatory policing is also a severe problem in the EU. And when policies and policing are discriminatory, it gives way to vigilante behavior against migrants and asylum seekers, who have minimal access to victim support services to begin with.
Iran has been better for us. The security we enjoy here is perhaps unparalleled in the world. If you don't commit a crime and live as Iranians do, nobody would bother you. It also depends on how hardworking you are. If I don't work that hard after I was given refuge, I could have been a sanitary worker right now. Iran is very safe. If you're working properly, there are good job opportunities here too.
Interestingly, even EU authorities and private companies commit hate crimes. These crimes include threats, intimidation, and killings. And what's being done about that? Of the 14 member states covered in a 2016 report by the FRA, only Finland, Germany, the Netherlands, and Greece monitor and collect data on hate crimes against asylum seekers and their accommodations. The FRA is the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights. While talking of immigrants' contribution to Iran, incoming asylum seekers have been more of a weight on the government and system. The majority of Afghan immigrants being typically unskilled illegal workers expecting lower wages and agreeing to less agreeable working conditions, they have been a serious competition for unskilled Iranian workers. Between 1976 and 2006, Afghan immigrants reportedly led to an increase in unemployment in Iran, almost replacing unskilled Iranian workers. This is on top of desperation and culture-specific crimes they are known to have committed, which is yet another concern for the system. Mr. Abedi corrects me as per the nature of their job preferences or possibilities.
Some
might say that Afghans are more involved in doing labor and jobs like that. But the reality is that Afghans are involved in dried fruits and nuts and economic activities like import and exports. They are present in the construction and housing sectors. This is despite some legal issues with Afghans and banking problems, but they are still following these activities. They are doing economic activities in Iran, and some of them have accumulated great wealth and have been able to improve their financial status.
Plans are spread out, but when concerned, even culpable parties will recognize their responsibility, and when immigrant caseloads will be distributed more equally between countries, doesn't appear to be anytime close. While thousands come in every day, only hundreds have left over the course of a year. Over the course of 2020, 947 individuals are known to have returned to their countries of origin from Iran. And in September 2021, only 800 refugees returned to Afghanistan. That'll be it for today. I return with no furniture, but a lot wealthier, knowledge-wise. Thanks for joining us on this trip down to the woodwork factories. Do join us again at the same times next week and each week after, as there's no telling where we'll be taking you next. Bye for now.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
Qala al-Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, khayru al-umuri awsatuha.
Ziyarah of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai, Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue.
a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام عند قبر حضرة: إن شيئا هذا آخره لحقيق أن يزهد في أوله، وإن شيئا هذا أوله لحقيق أن يخاف آخره.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, while standing at a graveside, stated, "Indeed, something that ends with this is worthy of its beginning, being spent in abstemiousness. And indeed, something that begins with this is worthy of its end, being feared with apprehension."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When we're talking about the interesting and beautiful conversations of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that there are some stories from his childhood which are truly incredible and amazing. One example of this story from his childhood, which deals with the conversation, has been reported by Safwan al-Jammal. Now, this individual, Safwan, has said that I, at one point in time, asked Abu Abdullah, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, about the leader of this affair after him. So in this conversation, Safwan asks Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, who is going to be the divinely appointed leader, the divinely appointed Imam after Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. So Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam replies that the leader of this affair, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, is one who does not fool and play. So Safwan says that while the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, was relating this story to me, Abu al-Hasan Musa ibn Ja'far was a young boy at the time, and he came towards us along with a group of young sheep. Safwan says that I heard Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam address the young sheep saying, "Prostrate to your Lord." After Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam said this statement of "Prostrate to your Lord," Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam came to Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, took him up and embraced the young child, and then said to him, "May my father and mother be ransom to you, O you who do not fool and play." And so, in this conversation between Safwan al-Jammal and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam and Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that the seventh divinely appointed successor in the household of the Holy Prophet was mentioned clearly for all. This is dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
For about 20 years, the seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, was in the service of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam's mother, who was a Moroccan origin, was also a very renowned and pious personality who have definitely contributed in the purity of the sixth Imam as well. When we look at the period, the political period, at that time, we find that Imam have attended or Imam faced about six tyrannical khulafa. Sajjah, who was known to be the most furious, the blood-sucking Khalifa of that time, because the period is where we are seeing the downfall of the Umayyads and the coming to power of the Abbasids. So it's a time where there is a lot of turmoil. Everyone who is about to lose the power want to be extremely furious, extremely, you know, bloodthirsty, with the want to rule with the iron fist so that they could save the power. And the tyrants and the oppressors and the khulafa who wants to come to power once again, responding or trying to come to power with the iron fist as well. So it was Sajjah, and then after that it was Mansur al-Dawaniqi, who was also a very cruel, cunning figure in the Islamic history, who have even brought Imam from Medina to Baghdad. And as soon as Imam was summoned, basically forced to come, and there is that very famous dua of Imam Kazim alayhi salam that we have in Mafati and also in other dua books, which reflects that unique understanding of the Imam in regards to Tawheed, in regards to Tawheedi principles. That dua is fascinating and amazing. Highly recommend to be recited on the 25th of Rajab.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله يا من قد شئت فينا بالهدى والحب دينا أنت
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.